this week's 51%, we speak with counselor Kate King about the difference between good and bad relationships and how to decide whether to mend things or move on.
The body doesn't lie. And so every time you're with this person, if your body is like, no, no, that's another sign of a toxic relationship.
We also hear from singer-songwriter Al Olander about her new record, The Worrier. I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessie King. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and this week we're bringing you some reflections on love and loss. Love is a beautiful thing, but it's not always easy, and not all relationships are healthy. Hopefully your Valentine's Day plans involve celebrating the partner or friends you feel safest with. But if you and your partner are on the rocks, and you don't know what to do about it, our guest today has some advice. Kate King, who I should mention is not related to me, is a licensed counselor and board-certified art therapist from Denver, Colorado, who has been helping people navigate bumpy relationships and estranged families for nearly 20 years. Her latest book is called Mend or Move On, answering a question she gets asked a lot. Is this relationship worth fixing, or should I just call it quits? King says relationships arrive at this point in a lot of different ways. And the stress of making a decision often leads to people staying in unhappy or unsafe situations for far too long. She does believe if both people are on board, many relationships can mend. But the toxic ones are better left in the past. The key is knowing what toxic actually looks like, knowing your worth, and reaching out for support. For Valentine's Day, I spoke with King about what makes a good relationship and what makes a bad one. To be clear, King's book applies not only to romantic partners, but family, friends, and workplaces as well. Perhaps before we dive, I guess, into what unhealthy relationships look like, maybe we should start on a nice note. What makes a good relationship? You know, I've always heard communication is key, but what else makes a relationship healthy?
Yeah, I actually, the last chapter in my book is called 6 Relationship Tools You Don't Want to Leave Home Without. And those are basically like the biggies that make relationships successful. And communication is one of them. Another one is curiosity. When people can just approach the person that they're connected to with an open mind and an open heart and really just sort of be open to the differences between them. And instead of projecting judgments or assumptions, they ask questions like, oh, like, tell me more about that. Or how is that for you? Or, wow, I didn't really expect that. Can you say more? Things like that can really gain you a lot of traction in relationships so that you can gain more intimacy and get to know each other deeper instead of just based on your assumptions. So curiosity is probably my very favorite quality. And other relationship signs that they're healthy are basically that there's a sense of you feel like you can be your authentic self with that person. You're not beating around the bush, walking on eggshells. You don't find yourself shape-shifting when you're with them. And you don't worry about backlash if you're going to be your true self, if you have to maybe have a hard conversation. There's a level of trust and safety in healthy relationships that allows for a little bit of discomfort. And it allows for there to be a challenge to the homeostasis and the status quo so that you can continue to grow together, which is also another indication of a healthy relationship, is that they're very focused on growing together and sort of meeting with each other at different stages of life rather than being based on the past or maybe the history. A lot of people will say, you know, I've been in a relationship with this person since high school, but we don't have a lot in common anymore. And that's a relationship that's based in the past and not the present. So not to say that you couldn't build something with a past person in the present, but I think that's really important that there's an element of knowing them now, being curious about who they are, feeling accepting and open to be yourself around them in the present.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, you know, what does a not so good or bad relationship look like? And I guess, how do you know the difference between something like, oh, this relationship is stuck in the past, and oh, this relationship is actually toxic? Because I feel like that word toxic has been thrown around, I mean, so many times that it's practically lost its meaning at this point.
It's a really important distinction. And like you said, social media has made it like these pop psychology phrases like toxic or narcissist or gaslighting. They are used so much as blanket statements and so inaccurately that I think it almost turns people's attention off because they're used too much. So basically, actually, I start my book with definitions because I think it's important to have them. So I actually have dictionary definitions as well as my own definitions of toxicity, toxic relationship, toxic person, and healthy relationship. But essentially, not all bad relationships are toxic, but all toxic relationships are bad. So sometimes you can be in a misaligned relationship. You can outgrow someone. You can kind of expire the season where the connection feels really strong and it doesn't make it toxic. It doesn't make the other person toxic if they're irritating or annoying or if they're not showing up for you in the ways that you want. That's just misalignment. Toxicity, there are three qualities that I generally look for. The first is that the negative behavior is consistent and persistent. So it's not a one-time thing. There's this deep sense of dysfunction and it keeps happening. It's like every time it's present and you notice it and you are having fewer and fewer experiences with them that actually feel positive. So that would be the first sign. The second is that it's truly harmful. Toxic relationships are abusive, they're corrosive, they whittle away at your self-esteem, they harm you on an emotional or psychological or physical level, and you have to actually like pick up the pieces and do damage control after you see them. You have to call your therapist right away. So that's another quality. And then the last is there's an experience in the body. It's like a push-pull kind of conflict that happens where like you're attracted to them, but you're repulsed from them. You have like a knot in your gut and your shoulders are near your ears and your throat feels tight. Like your body is screaming no when you're with this person. And it can also show up as like severe exhaustion that happens after you see them or depletion. And so like the mind can be really easily manipulated. It's malleable and influenceable, but the body doesn't lie. And so every time you're with this person, if your body is like, no, that's another sign of a toxic relationship.
In the book, you identify what you call the seven traps of toxic relationships. Without spoiling too much, what are some of those traps and how do you get out of them?
Right. So I actually in the book lay out how to recognize a trap, what happens like when you're in the snare of it, and then how to get out of it and not repeat it. And so each of these traps is really, we do a deep dive in the book. But I'll read them to you and I'll kind of give you a little explanation of each. So the first trap is buy-in. And this is when you're bought into the story of whatever the toxic relationship is selling, whether it's like, oh, like this is just how we are in our family, or whether it's like, well, you're the problem and I am perfect. Like the buy-in, not challenging it, not really fighting back, just going along with the narrative. The second trap is comfort. When people get so comfortable in the dynamic that they're almost like asleep to the dysfunction. They're comfortable in that sense of normalcy to the extent where they don't realize that it's abnormal or dysfunctional. They don't realize that they deserve better. It's like too comfortable. The third is powerlessness. So this is where people just give away their power. They feel small. They feel collapsed in the relationship. And this can happen when someone is very like domineering, when there's control and power dynamics or manipulation at hand. That is usually designed to make someone feel powerless and stuck in the relationship so they don't feel like they can leave. So we see that a lot in really abusive relationships. The fourth trap is false ownership. And this is when someone takes it all on as their own responsibility. Like all the problems in this relationship are my fault. If only I could figure out how to change in the right way, then this would be better. But in reality, relationships are a dance between people. It's never all one person's fault. But that is a really common narrative that is in these toxic relationships. The fifth is unhealed trauma. So if someone is relating through their unhealed wounds, they're not really seeing the relationship clearly. They're coming from parts of them that are adaptive, that are protecting them, that are focused on their nervous system feeling unsafe. They're not really connecting with genuineness. And so, if people can start to heal their own personal trauma, they'll notice that they show up differently in this toxic relationship. And sometimes that's actually what disrupts the dynamic and helps to either get them to that mend or move on point. But unhealed trauma can definitely get in the way. And then the sixth trap is avoidance. This is when people just don't want to look at the problem. They don't want to admit that the toxic relationship is toxic. They don't want to talk about the dysfunction. Like, they're happy to skate on the surface of it and avoid that it's a problem. This is not sustainable. Eventually, it becomes such a pervasive problem that they really can't avoid it. But a lot of people will sort of coast in avoidance for as long as they can to avoid the discomfort of like facing it. And then the last one is codependency. So codependency is essentially where you don't really know where your edges are, where I end and you begin, and I can only be happy if you're happy, and if you're not happy, then I'm not happy, and it's like this symbiosis that forms. So I try to teach people to move to a state of interdependency, which is a concept from Dr. Dan Siegel, and it's about being able to like flow and lean on each other and be there for each other, but also remaining two separate autonomous beings, not getting so enmeshed with each other that your edges are blurred. So those are the seven traps.
Is it possible to be like too walled off or independent too? Because I feel like a lot of the way we talk about relationships, especially romantic ones, like we talk about them like they're a gamble. Like, you got to put yourself out there or be willing to be vulnerable or be willing to let someone else take care of you and for you to take care of them. And you're like, I guess, like, what's the middle ground on how open you should be without putting yourself in harm's way?
Well, I think emotional safety is paramount in relationships. And we're not supposed to be able to be emotionally safe to that level with everyone in our lives. So, generally, most people have about 150 people in their sphere of their social network. And it's, everything from like the closest friends and family to acquaintances. And it's not appropriate to have that level of intimacy and depth with your acquaintances. Like, we can't manage that many close connections. We would be stretched too thin. And so it's important. I talk about the three different kinds of relationships in the book. So some of them are relationships of utility, where it's like, this is your favorite server at your very favorite restaurant. You talk about, current events or small talk, but you're not going to share your family trauma there. That's not emotionally safe, right? Whereas a relationship of appreciation has that depth and intimacy where maybe you fostered the safety to be able to really go there and you've experienced that through time. So you have repetitive, positive experiences of trust that tell you that that's a safe relationship. And so it is important that we be vulnerable with our closest people because vulnerability and authenticity build intimacy. But we have to be careful not to be using vulnerability as bids for connection with people who are not emotionally safe, who we don't have that feedback loop with, that we can truly be in a safety when we're with them. So does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. So the title of the book is Mend or Move On. For anyone who is weighing those two options right now, I guess what advice do you have for them in that moment? Because I feel like a lot of the things that we're talking about, a relationship might look pretty obviously toxic or not good to people outside that relationship, but it can be a lot harder to see and to make that decision when you're actually in it.
Oh, totally. And that's where the unhealed trauma comes into play because you might be acting out a very young pattern that's been with you from your early childhood. Maybe you were taught that you have to be a caregiver of other people in order to earn love and belonging. And so you're like overfunctioning and overgiving in all of your relationships, feeling like, oh, I'm showing up with love and kindness, but really, you're actually showing up in this transactional way of like, I'll give you love and support and overfunctioning if you give me belonging, but that's not healthy, right? So we all have baggage and we all have patterns like that. And when you do the inner work, you start to notice what yours are. And so if you can start to take authority over healing some of your patterns, then your connection ends up being kind of more clean and more pure. You can see more clearly what you're working with. So if you're at this mend or move on choice point and you know what's yours and you know what's not yours, then you can both come to the table. And I would say having everyone on board to do the repair work is the most essential ingredient if it's going to be able to be mended. Otherwise, if only one person's willing to do the work and the repair and foster the healing, and the other person is either in denial or avoidance or blame or accusation or aggression, it's not going to work. You need to have all parties at the table in that curiosity perspective with the intention to work on it if it's going to be healed. So I would say, like, if somebody's listening and they're like, oh, I'm at this mend or move on place, thing number one is everyone involved willing to work on this? Because you have to start there.
If you do decide you're both willing to mend things, what does that work look like? How do you have those conversations without falling back into old arguments or starting new ones?
Oh, totally. Actually, I have a whole chapter in the book called, it's a chapter about triggering words, and there's like a list of certain words to steer away from when you're having these hard conversations. One of the words is triggered because that's a triggering word in itself. But if we use certain words, we're more likely to have people like get defensive and get their back up versus if we use other forms of communication, like using I statements, owning your experience, having questions like what's that like for you, or what do you think created that problem? Like those types of things tend to move the direction in a positive way better than some of these really triggering words. Yeah, definitely the words that we use. And also, I don't think that you have to do this by yourself, especially if you're dealing with long-standing relationships like family or spousal relationships. You can ask for help from a therapist. There are people who are trained in being able to be a neutral third party who can hold a container for this to go well, where like they will help you keep your temperature at a neutral place and they'll help kind of hear both people's perspectives and give you tools because we don't necessarily know the tools to work through difficult conversations. I wasn't taught that in my upbringing, So there's no shame in asking for a third party professional to help kind of mediate this experience.
Okay. And for those who decide to cut ties, I mean, there's a lot of discourse online right now about parental estrangement, and we've had this conversation a couple times on our show. But, if you decide to cut ties with someone, be it a friend, a family member, or a partner, what do you want them to know?
It's important that you have support if you're going to make that cut, especially if it's with those really deep relationships, like with parents, or if you're breaking up a marriage and it feels like that's where a lot of your support is surrounded around. It's really important because it can be the fight of your life to break free from people who are really toxic, from abusive dynamics, controlling dynamics. And so, having a therapist of your own, having healthy friendships and healthy people in your life who can help you remember why you're cutting ties and how hard you've worked to repair it and it didn't ever work, and the way that you kept looping, because you tend to forget that sometimes when you're going through this process. And so, having a really trusted person who's like, I watched you loop in this for decades, and you were crying every time you left them. And there was, you were manifesting physical symptoms of maybe like IBS or skin issues or headaches because of the stress of this relationship. So having support is just absolutely essential. And then I would say it's really important just to sort of take care of yourself in the process because it can be jarring for your nervous system to end a relationship that's been really deeply wired into who you are and what your life is. And so it takes time sometimes to regulate. It's not just like you cut ties with someone who's toxic and suddenly you feel so free, right? There might be a grief period. There might be a period where you're confused or you feel untethered or you're not really sure if you're okay, or maybe you're having physical symptoms like your anxiety increases. And all of that can be very normal as your nervous system is starting to recalibrate because your homeostasis resets. You had this person in your life for a long time and you were at a certain baseline managing that. And without them in your life, your baseline changes. And so I think it's important to just be gentle and to show up for yourself with love.
Kate King is a licensed counselor and board-certified art therapist from Denver, Colorado, and the author of Mend or Move On, which is out now through Johns Hopkins University Press. You can learn more about Kate's work at her website, theradiantlifeproject.com. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Singer-songwriter Al Olander is out with a new album on love, lust, and loss called The Worrier on February 13th. Olander has never really been afraid to put her heart out there. Her debut record, released in 2022, was literally called Easy Crier. She's in a new season of life now. She's spent the past few years opening for bands like Shovels and Rope, Deer Tick, and Lucius, and she's getting ready to launch an expansive U.S. tour this spring. But The Worrier still has her reflecting on her anxieties, grief, and all the different kinds of love in her life. To celebrate the album's release, Olander is hosting her fourth annual Allentine's Day party and concert at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston, New York on February 13th. Ahead of the show, Olander spoke with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke and brought her guitar to give us a preview.
I cannot believe I'm about to say this. I recorded the entire record and then I re-recorded it.
Okay.
I made a record and something told me I needed to make a different record. I didn't think I could give myself permission to do that. I didn't think that I was able to make that decision for myself. And in a way, maybe I wasn't financially but I felt drawn to it and I laid awake at night and I kept thinking, I think I need to make a different record.
It's a different track list too, or you re-recorded the same list of songs or did write new songs in the interim?
A little of both.
Okay.
A little of both. And yeah, I made one record, which it doesn't even feel real that happened, but I made a new record with all of my dear friends, and I think it's a very true record.
When you think of, as the creator of the record, when you think of it on the whole, what is the, I mean, the songs have individual stories, but what's the feeling? How did you encapsulate yourself in this time on your album?
I'll start with this. Listeners, have you ever had a crush? Sarah, have you ever had a crush?
Oh my goodness.
Okay.
Have I ever not had a crush?
That's what, you know what, if I could give a message, yes, it would be that. Have I not had a crush? I think that I'm a lover girl. I wrote this record as a love letter to myself, to these crushes I've had, to the crushes I will have, to heartbreak. It's been 4 years since my first record came out.
Mm-hmm. Easy Crier.
Easy Crier. And this record, although I've grown, I realized I'm still a person that feels deeply, that worries, that can't. I don't know. I'm just human. I am so human that it hurts. And I thought I need to write something that maybe other folks will think, will see their humanness as well.
The title track is The Worrier. When did you write the song, The Worrier, and what is it sort of, what do you worry about in it?
Oof. Listeners, have you ever been worried that you've failed people you love?
Have I ever not been worried that I failed people I love?
I cannot believe how much time I've spent as a touring musician running away from folks that I love, worried that they won't love me if I mess up, worried about death, worried about intimacy, worried about money. I worry about everything. And The Worrier is me over a season worrying about if I am not, if I don't show up for someone, will they leave me? If I'm not perfect for someone, will they leave me? Am I good enough to have this community? Am I good enough to have these friends? And I think the answer is I have become a person that doesn't just get left, that I'm not going to get left behind. And I can say I'm sorry, and I can admit when I'm wrong, and I can show up for people, and I'm not running away.
Felt like the end of the world in New York on New Year's Eve. Took a pill, got kicked out of the bar, and I told you, you should leave me. You said it I finally
That's a little bit of The Worrier from Al Olander's new album, The Worrier. The fourth annual Allentine's Day at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston, New York is on Friday, February 13th, which is the release date of The Worrier. I want to tell you, the song Miracle Boy has me deep in my feelings. I love the early lyric, I hate that breakfast is reserved for the living. I love it because that is such a thing, like when you lose someone, it's the surprising small things you wish you could still share with them. Is that about your brother specifically?
It is, Sarah. Thanks for asking. I really do appreciate that because I know it's hard to talk about grief and death and we're scared of it, but my brother passed away 12 years ago. Oh, it's so long.
Yeah.
And his name was Keith. And he's my older brother. And I've written some songs about him before, about how I felt about him. But I think Miracle Boy is my first song that is genuinely just about him and who he was. And he was so fun and so funny and so cool. And everybody loved him. And my mom gave him the nickname Miracle Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, if I can make anybody feel anything or connect with their grief to make us feel less alone, then I would be doing a service for myself, and for Keith would also really appreciate it. He would think I'm getting too much attention for it, for sure. He would definitely be like, okay, you're going to use that, huh?
That comes through in the song.
Okay, good, yes. Good. Yeah, so it's the little things that I miss so much. I just wish he would think it's really cool that I'm playing on the radio right now for all these folks to listen to, and he would think that the event is cool, and he would have crushes on all my gorgeous friends. And I would say, you stay away from them. So I just miss him a lot. And I really want to. This record's very vulnerable. That song's very vulnerable.
It is. We are almost out of time, which is devastating because every time I get you here, I want to talk to you for 45 days at least. But you are going to leave us all happy by playing a song. Tell us about The Cyclone.
The Cyclone was the first single from the record, and it goes through a season of crushes. It really does. I know you're all shocked to hear that. But it's just about truly being on the ride, being on the journey, and it's about the excitement, the ups and downs. And I could truly spend all day with you, Sarah, but I'm going to play hard to get and get out of here.
Driving to Queens to try to get laid. My brain is bad, my body's worse. They're gonna roll me out of New York in a shiny black hearse, yeah. You found a penny from 93 right there in Baltimore. Traffic made you think about me. You'd risk it all to pick it up. You said you'd done stupider things for just a bit of good luck. Of the cyclone that day, I was only afraid you'd hear me screaming your name, and I was never the same. Brushing my teeth at the Planet Fit, I wish I never asked if you were double jointed. I watch the spit, I wash my hair, I wanna text you, but it's desperate. I'll pretend I don't care, yeah. Drove too fast through Silver Lake. You said I'm gonna take you out, but I swear it's not a date. You locked the steering wheel up to my wrist. Here's a bunch of keys, you gotta see which one fits. I wasn't afraid of the cyclone that day. I was only afraid you'd hear me screaming. And I won't be ashamed. Close to death, I saw your face. Now I wanna replace all my glass with paper plates. The inside cannot break.
That was singer-songwriter Al Olander speaking with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke. Al's new record is The Worrier, out February 13th. Her fourth annual Allentine's Day party and concert is the same evening at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston, New York. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete, sweet.